The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main
they are
start. Four, three, two, one.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good morning, listeners. Welcome to this Friday morning Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston, and thank you for tuning in. A couple of quick announcements. First of all, we're on the 60-minute format, and we will have a hard stop at 60 minutes from now, 10:30 California time. So if you do have a comment or question for our guests, please watch the time and make sure you get it in before we end the show today. And also, we are co-hosted with Space Show listener and frequent caller John Hunt, who knows a whole lot more about physics than I do, so he's here to help out. And we appreciate John being with us. So a couple of quick announcements before I introduce our guest. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners, and let the phone ring. I'll answer and bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also reach us through Dr. Space, DRSPACE, at thespaceshow.com. And in addition, our blog for this show, which is on our website all the way over to the far right, the upcoming show menu. The first program listed is this program. Open that archive page up, and then comments and questions are down at the bottom. As soon as you post your comment or question, I can easily integrate it into our program today. So because we have a great guest and we're on the 60-minute program, I'm skipping most everything else. But what I do want to tell you is that we are in the annual fundraising campaign period for the Space Show, which is a 501c3 nonprofit. And your contributions to the show keep us on the air and doing programs like the one you're going to be hearing today. So if you like that and you get the content free of charge, please do support us. Remember, if you're a U.S. taxpayer, you get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true if you're a California taxpayer. We're a California public benefit corporation here in California with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And your support is definitely appreciated. You will see how to support us on our homepage, center right, through PayPal or an address for mailing checks for those of you who don't like to do things electronically. I also want to add that Amazon has great ways to support nonprofits, and we participate in two of their programs where Amazon donates a part of your purchase price to the nonprofit of your choice. In this case, One Giant Leap, the Space Show. So if you click on the big Amazon link in the center of our page, it will take you to those two programs on the One Giant Leap page and explain them to you. And it doesn't require anything more on your part than to use a One Giant Leap profile or portal, or to use the Amazon clone page for nonprofits, which is called smile.amazon.com. Everything about that page is identical to the regular Amazon page, except that purchases are credited toward the nonprofit you select, and One Giant Leap is one of those that are selected. And then finally, it is the gift-giving season, so remember, we do have a store. It is in the upper left menu under support, and you might find some items there for your favorite Space Show fan, Space Show listener, stocking stuffers, things of that nature. So do check it out, and we certainly do appreciate your support. Inquiries are always welcome, And just email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And also, we're now opening up for corporate sponsors or sponsors in general for 2018. So if you have any interest in that, please do get a hold of me. Remember, you get banner ads and a short message read on each Space Show program that is at regular length, the 90-minute program. So I do want to thank our sponsors briefly for today's program, and that includes the Integrated Space Plan. It also includes the Space Foundation with their upcoming symposium in April, and Orbital ATK, AIAA, and Celestis. And we really appreciate those sponsors and could not be doing the program without them. You can call and talk to our guest, who I will introduce in just a minute, 1-866-687-7223. The telephone is our preferred way of communicating with our guests, so hopefully you can use it. Email, as I said before, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and then, of course, our blog. And with that, I've already told you that John Hunt is co-hosting, so you all know him through many different Space Show programs and his frequent calling of the program. But we are also pleased to bring to the Space Show for the first time Dr. Miguel Alcubierre. I hope I've pronounced your name correctly, Miguel. And he is best known, although he has a whole different area of professional interest that we're going to talk about, for his Alcubierre warp drive, which is a theoretical means of traveling faster than light, which doesn't violate any physical principle that nothing can locally travel faster than light. He authored the warp drive, hyperfast travel within general relativity. And we're going to talk about that and ask him for sort of updates, since he did that at paper as a student many, many years ago. His specialty is in gravity waves and relativity and other parts of theoretical physics. And it's going to be a real pleasure, and it will be and is an honor to talk to you. Miguel, welcome to the Space Show. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm fine, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Thank you. Let's start out, and as I understand, you wrote the warp drive paper as a graduate student. Why? What prompted you to do that? Were you enamored with Star Trek or science fiction, or why do it, and have you reflected on it, and how would you change it 20-plus years later?
Well, yeah, I did it because I've always liked science fiction. I'm a Star Trek fan. I wouldn't actually call myself a Trekkie because I don't dress up like Star Trek or anything like that or go to conventions, but I like the show. And I've always read science fiction since I was very young. So that was the essential motivation. At the time, I was doing a PhD in Wales, in Britain. And I was doing a PhD in black holes, nothing to do with warp drive. But black holes are part of Einstein's theory of relativity. And in this theory of relativity, you can warp space, you can curve space. So when I was watching one day this Star Trek, actually the Next Generation, I don't remember which episode, but I was watching one of them, and I started thinking maybe we can use relativity, Einstein's theory of relativity, to find a way to warp space that actually reproduces some of the properties one would expect from a functioning warp drive. And thinking about that, I came up with this idea of expanding space and contracting space. So I was also thinking at the time about the expansion of space. You know that we all know that space expands in Hubble. And people usually don't understand it, because when people hear that space expands, they think that the galaxies are just flying apart from some big explosion at the center of something. But that's not the way it works. When we physicists talk about it, what we mean is that the galaxies are essentially just at rest where they are, and space in between them grows. It expands. Space is dynamical. So I thought maybe we can do the same thing, but instead of expanding the whole of the universe, maybe we should just expand a little bit of the universe behind the spaceship. And if we contract a little bit of the universe in front of the spaceship, then we can make the spaceship move along without actually moving. It's space, the one that's doing the job. And also we know from the expansion of the universe that it is possible for space to expand faster than light. There's nothing against that in the laws of physics. Actually, it does it all the time. There's galaxies sufficiently far away in the universe that they're moving away from us faster than light. And that is no problem because, as I mentioned, they are not actually moving. It's space itself, the one that is expanding. So it doesn't violate any of the laws of physics. So I thought maybe you can do this locally, small, in a small bubble of space expanding behind you and contracting in front of you, and that will make the spaceship move in principle at any speed, even faster than light. So that was just a flash of inspiration watching the show. And the next morning I went into the office to do the calculations, which are not trivial. And it turned out that it worked, at least in paper. So I decided that it was a good idea. I wrote it up. At the time, I had never actually published a scientific paper in my life. I was still only a very young graduate student. So I went to my supervisor, and I showed what I had written, and I fully expected him to tell me to go back and do my real research and forget about this. But he didn't. He was actually extremely encouraging. His name is Bernard Schutz, by the way. He's involved in this gravitational wave discovery. And he encouraged me to publish it. He was actually the one that told me that I should put the words, the warp drive in the title, weren't there originally. So it came out, and that's essentially the story of the paper and the idea I had. I just left it there because I didn't know at the time how to continue it, how to go further. So I just published one paper, and I have never gone back to the topic. And it's just exploded on its own.
I mean, a lot of people are researching it. So is their research, you know, grounded? Is it real? I mean, is what you suggested at all plausible? I mean, I know the issue of negative energy came up at the Starship Congress. So explain all of this to us.
There's many issues with it. The first issue was the negative energy. That I knew myself from the very beginning. It's actually in my original paper. Because you see, the way it works in the theory of Einstein, you know that concentrations of matter and energy produce a curvature of space-time. And normally that's the way we solve the equations. When we say we solve Einstein's equations, it's because we imagined a certain distribution of mass and energy, say a star or a galaxy, and then we put that into the equations and solve the equations to find what the geometry and the curvature of space-time has to be corresponds to that distribution of mass and energy. But what I did in this case is just the opposite. Is you come up with a nice geometry, a nice curvature of space-time that you like, and then you plug it into the equations and use those equations to read off the distribution of mass and energy you need. Normally, we don't call that a solution. It's just like the opposite way to go about it. But when you do that, in the case of the warp drive, you find very quickly that you need negative energy. And negative energy, it might not sound very scary, but it is actually very scary because if you remember Einstein's famous equation, E equals mc squared, it tells you that energy is equal mass times the speed of light squared. And from that equation, you see if you want negative energy, that implies negative mass. And negative mass, as far as we know, doesn't exist. It's not actually forbidden in the laws of physics, but it just doesn't seem to exist. So I put that in the original paper. I said, okay, the geometry is nice. This geometry would allow you to do what you want, but you need negative energy. This is a big problem. We don't know if negative energy exists. And essentially I left it there. I made a small comment about the fact that there is, in quantum theory, some cases in which you can have very tiny amounts of negative energy, and those are allowed. They're extremely small. And in the case of the warp drive, you actually need huge quantities. And I just left it there. I knew there was this problem. There's other two problems with it. One that I didn't even bother to think about, but it's obvious in hindsight. Curving space is very difficult. You need huge masses to produce a very small curvature of space. The curvature of space around the Earth is extremely small. It's very difficult to measure. And the Earth is a big planet. And so if you want to produce a curvature of space for a warp drive, which is not trivial, it's a big distortion of space, you actually need a lot of energy. So you need negative energy, and you need lots of it. Initially, I didn't even do the calculation, but some people did the calculation a few years later, and then they realized that you would need essentially the whole mass of the universe in negative energy at first. Then somebody took to the beat and improved on the calculation, and eventually they came to the conclusion that in the best-case scenario, you would need about a Jupiter's mass equivalent of negative energy to propel a small spaceship using the warp drive. So that's a huge problem. Even if you can find negative energy, you would need to harness huge amounts of that. I mean, planet-sized amounts of negative energy, which is another extremely difficult problem to solve. And there's a third problem that I also knew when I wrote the paper. I didn't put it in the paper. And then that's how science works. You know something, you think, I won't bother, I won't put it in this paper. And then somebody else thinks the same thing and they publish it. And everybody thinks, they thought about it first, and well, they did publish it first. But the other problem was that if you want to use this warp drive to travel slower than light, then in principle there's no problem. You have the negative energy, but there's no other problems. But if you want to use it to travel faster than light, then you have an extra problem. And the extra problem is that you need to put some of this negative energy in a region in front of this bubble of curved space-time that you cannot reach from the space. It's disconnected from the spaceship. It's causally disconnected. You cannot reach it. So there's no way you can put it there because you can't reach it. So somebody would have to put it there from the outside, which again is a big problem. But we call that the horizon problem because there's a region beyond which you cannot reach to put the required negative energy. So we have these very difficult three problems. You need negative energy. You need huge amounts of negative energy, planet-sized amounts of negative energy. And then if you want to use it to travel faster than light, you need to solve the horizon problem. And nobody knows how to solve that problem. So because of those reasons, essentially, I just left the subject. There's people doing research, and they've published many things about it, and they have analyzed how much negative energy and see if you can reduce it. And they've analyzed the horizon problem. And then they've also done research into how it would look like if you were in a spaceship inside this bubble, how the universe would look like and things like that. So there's a lot of research going on, but nobody has been able to solve any of the fundamental problems, which is what I'm actually interested in. So that's why I've never been back to this subject.
I have an initial question from you for a listener, but I might preface this because listeners sort of assume this is common in space enthusiast world, that something already exists or is real. So they often ask questions and write questions as if what we're talking about is real and exists, which I find very, very interesting. But and I assume we're going to encounter that today. But this is from a spatial listener, Dr. Doug. He's a medical doctor in Southern California. Do you expand space in front and behind the craft once and then get a velocity, or do you have to keep expanding the space in front and in back in order to move?
Well, actually, you expand space behind you and you contract space in front of you, and you have to keep doing it all the way along. Otherwise, it doesn't work. It will just push you to a small distance and it will stop. So you need to keep doing it all along, all through your trajectory. And you need this bubble to go with you. It's a bit similar, but it's not the same. And so what happens when you go to an airport and you stand in one of these travelators, in which you don't walk, but you move, and what's happening is that behind you, the travelator is coming out of the floor, and in front of you, it's disappearing into the floor. So this is an analogy. It's something similar, but you would have to be producing space behind you and destroying space in front of you, contracting space in front of you. But you would need to be moving along with you, because what happens in a travelator is it only works for a small distance, and then you need another one, right?
Right.
So if you want to be able to do this all the time, you need the travelator to be moving along with you, right? Or essentially for an infinite distance. So you really need to be producing this effect all along the trajectory.
Do you know if, I see lots and lots of papers on warp drive, and I know NASA was looking at it with EagleWorks and others. Do you know if they're actually trying to solve the three challenges that you outlined a few minutes ago? Is anybody out there making serious progress on warp drive?
Not as far as I know. The only people that were supposed to be trying was a small group in NASA, Professor White, I think, Harold White.
Right, Sunny
but
White.
But I'm extremely skeptical about that because I haven't even been able to find a published paper in a scientific journal that talks about what they're supposed to be doing. And I don't see how they can be solving the problem of the negative energy. We don't have negative energy. As far as I know, it's impossible. It doesn't exist. So where do they get it from? And even if you do manage to get it from, say, quantum effects, as I mentioned, the quantum effects are extremely tiny, and you would need just the opposite. You need a planet-sized amount of negative energy. So I have no idea what they're doing. And as I said, I've never been able to see any technical description of what they're supposed to be doing. So I'm extremely skeptical. I don't really believe what they're doing makes any sense at all. But they're the only people that have ever, in principle, tried. But, yeah, I don't believe they're making any sense.
Is there any plausible theory or hope that someday faster-than-light travel might actually be possible?
I think think it's extremely unlikely at this point. I wouldn't say impossible, because after all, I wrote the paper. But I think at the moment it looks very unlikely, at least with this idea of the wild tribe, because of all these problems. The other possibility people have talked about is wormholes. And wormholes also are extremely unpractical, because we don't even know how to make one. But if we could make one, then many of the problems in that case would be smaller than the wall track. So a wormhole would probably work better, but that means we need to learn how to punch a hole through space, and we don't know how to do that. But again, even in that case, you need a lot of negative energy, planet-sized amounts of negative energy. But at least you wouldn't have the horizon problem, so that's another that's a trade-off. But at this point in time, I think it looks extremely unlikely, unless we have some breakthrough in new theoretical physics that we haven't thought of, which could happen, because we certainly don't know everything about the universe. So that could happen. I still keep thinking and hoping that maybe we'll find some way to use negative energy, maybe not to travel faster than light, but to travel close to the speed of light. Maybe we can manipulate the dark energy in the universe that we don't know what that is, but it exists. It has some kind of negative energy. And maybe we can manipulate the Higgs field, which produces mass in particles, and maybe we can change the mass of the particles. So those things could be possible in the future, but at the moment they look unlikely.
Well, just one of the issues that this all, this difficulty is partly is the very weakness of the gravitational constant compared to other fields.
Exactly.
I mean, it takes a tremendous amount of energy to produce this curvature.
Exactly. The gravitational constant is very, very small, which means that you need huge and huge amounts of mass to produce even a very tiny curvature. That's the reason why it's very difficult to measure the curvature of space and time around the Earth. I mean, time is also curved around the Earth. I mean, it goes a bit slower, but it's 1 second every 30 years. So we can measure it, but it's extremely small. It's also the reason why, when we talk about this subject in a minute, it's so difficult to measure gravitational waves, because they're so tiny, precisely because the effect in space-time is very, very small. And that's because gravity is the weakest force of them all, as far as we understand. We don't really know why that's the case, but that means it's very difficult to control gravity or to control the curvature of space-time. You just need huge amounts of matter, planet-sized or star-sized. It's just very difficult.
Yeah. I was wondering, another possibility, which is pretty vague, but is it maybe there could be some other mode of interaction with gravity that we haven't discovered yet, that doesn't occur at natural levels, which would create a more profound curvature with less energy than we would see just in the natural, just a piece of mass like a planet sitting there curving space. I wonder.
Exactly. I mean, that would be extremely interesting, but at the moment it's not something we know of. At the moment, what we have is Einstein's field equations, which involve the constant of gravity, which is extremely small. But yeah, if something like that would happen, if we could find a way in which would have a position with effects of the curvature of space-time with far less energy, I mean, that would be fantastic, because it would allow us to do many, many things, not just walk thrice, but maybe flying cars and a lot of other things, right?
All sorts of stuff.
Gravity as well,
There seems to be funding and efforts for doing some kind of flight or experiments at much higher speeds than we have today, but say only a quarter or a third the speed of light, using very tiny little wafers that have hardly any mass, plus laser propulsion. Any thoughts on that as an approach? Could laser propulsion be so upscaled and made powerful enough to actually propel something of a decent size mass at a third or a fourth the speed of light?
I'm not an expert in the field, but I think propelling something that's very tiny, it's plausible. Even Hawking has mentioned this. I think propelling a very small microsatellite with lasers from the Earth is plausible. But propelling a large spaceship that can carry people, that seems at the moment beyond our technological capability. It would require huge amounts of energy, even just to travel at 30% the speed of light. The amount of energy you would require to push that craft to that speed is something the whole planet Earth doesn't have today. It would mean more energy than the whole planet uses today just to do that. So it doesn't mean we won't be able to do it in 100 years. We might be able to, because by then we'll have much more energy available, almost surely. but and eventually it might become plausible. But if you do that, I always wonder, because if you push a spacecraft with lasers to very large speed, then how do you slow it down on the other side? You don't have the lasers on the other side. So how do you slow it? It will just cruise past all the stars at 30% of the speed of light. So I think that's on that side impractical. If you send a probe, then maybe you don't want to slow it down. You don't care. We'll just zoom past the solar system in a couple of days, and well, we take all the pictures you can, and that's it. Right? But if you send people, you need to slow it down. So I think that's also impractical at the moment, but maybe it's plausible in the future. Also, there's this idea of propelling spaceship is with nuclear energy or even with antimatter, and I think that's also perfectly plausible. It's beyond our technological capabilities today, but in 100 years or 200, maybe it will be possible. There's nothing against that. There's no laws of physics that stops you from doing that. It's just the technology is very challenging.
Fascinating. So if we leave this part behind, unless we get a couple more questions from listeners, and then speaking about gravity waves, I know there was big news a couple of months ago about these stars in a sort of a neutron star collision. Can you help us understand what happened and why this was such a huge announcement?
Yes, of course. Well, just before that, I would like to say that we prefer to call them gravitational waves, not gravity waves, because gravity waves are confusing. There's something else that's called gravity waves that has nothing to do with that. It has to do with fluctuations in clouds and things like that, and so on. So because the name is confusing, we tend to prefer to call them gravitational waves just to avoid the confusion. But gravitational waves have been predicted for a long time. Einstein predicted them first 100 years ago in 1916. But again, because the constant of gravity is so small, it means that gravitational waves are extremely weak. And they're so weak, they're very, very difficult to measure. Actually, measuring a gravitational wave today is equivalent to being able to measure something the size of a human hair in a distance comparable to the distance from here to Alpha Centauri. And you should be able to measure that distance to an accuracy higher than the width of one human hair. So that's what you need to do. And that's why it took so long for us to be able to do it. I'm still amazed that we can do it today. The technology is extremely sophisticated. But they were finally, with these huge observatories, essentially LIGO, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Antenna Observatory, that has two of those observatories, one in Louisiana and one in the state of Washington. They were finally able to measure gravitational waves for the first time 2 years ago in September 2015. In that case, the gravitational waves came from the collision of two black holes, which was a huge announcement in and of itself. It gave a Nobel Prize. The Nobel Prize of Physics in 2017 was given to three people because of the discovery of gravitational waves. It's a huge breakthrough because we can see things that we wouldn't be able to see with light. I mean, gravitational waves are not light. They're distortions in the geometry of space. And, for example, we wouldn't be able to see black holes with light because they don't emit light. But when two black holes collide, there's no light, but there is gravitational waves. And you can measure them, and you can detect these black holes, which is amazing. And then in the next couple of years, they detected about four more systems of black hole collisions. Now, why are we detecting black hole collisions? Because before anything else, because black holes tend to be big. Usually, the black holes we've been seeing about 30, 20, 30, maybe a bit more solar masses, which means they're big. And since they're big, the gravitational waves they produce are stronger. And since they're stronger, they're easier to see. So that's why we see them first. It's what we call a selection effect. You see first what is easy to see, not necessarily because it's the only thing that's there, but that's what is easy to see. But a month ago, they announced something different, a very spectacular result that we were expecting, but we didn't know exactly what was going to happen. And that was not the collision of two black holes. It was the collision of two stars, two neutron stars. We knew that neutron stars would be out there, and they would be living in pairs every now and again, in binary systems. And in these binary systems, there would be emitting gravitational waves all the time for millions of years. The gravitational waves carry energy. And because energy has to be conserved, then as the gravitational waves take energy away from the systems, the stars would be closer and closer, and eventually they would collide. We knew that, and we actually even modeled these things in computers. But we hadn't seen it. And they actually saw it a couple of months ago. They saw a signal interesting gravitational waves, it was clear there was a collision of almost certainly two neutron stars because of the masses. The object had about two times the mass of the sun each of them. So with those masses, it was very unlikely that there were black holes. There were almost certainly neutron stars. And then once they saw these things in gravitational waves, they made an announcement. It was still secret. They didn't make an announcement to the general public. They made an announcement to the other observatories, which would, they have an agreement, and they sent this announcement saying, we saw this. We think it's the collision of two neutron stars. We saw the gravitational waves. Has anybody else seen something? And the interesting thing is that when two black holes collide, you don't see lights because they don't emit light. But when two stars collide, that's very different. That's a big explosion. There's a lot of gas there. There's a huge explosion. You expect to see it in light, and you expect to see it in X-rays and in gamma rays and everything. So they sent this announcement, and yet within about half an hour, one of the observatories, actually the people that control a satellite, the Fermi satellite, that looks for gamma ray bursts in space, said, yeah, we did detect a gamma ray burst at about the same time, actually 2 seconds after you say you saw the gravitational wave, we detected a huge gamma ray burst in the same region of the sky in which you saw the gravitational wave. Now, gravitational wave detectors are very poor at localizing signals. They can tell you I saw something, and they can tell you more or less where, but the region of space where they can point is really big. So it's much bigger than the full moon. So you can see, well, somewhere there, something interesting happened. And the gamma ray observatories are just as poor at pointing. So again, they tell you around there, and both coincided more or less in the region. So immediately they contacted other observatories, people with the normal telescopes, people that see light, the one who can see visible light. And they told them, we saw something interesting in this region. Can you look? And it turns out that in that region, there's hundreds of galaxies. But they pointed their telescopes, and a few hours later, a telescope in Chile actually pointing in that direction. They analyzed the light from several hundred galaxies in just a few hours, and they discovered one galaxy where they had a nova, a new star that wasn't there a week before, in one of the galaxies in this region. They actually called it a kilonova, which is a name most people probably haven't heard, because the people have heard of supernovas. A kilonova is something that is not as bright as a supernova, which is why it's called only a kilonova. It's actually brighter than a standard nova, but what more people usually don't know about novas either. A nova is just a star that flares up. A supernova is a star that explodes. And this kilonova is these two stars colliding. So they found it in invisible light as well. And this lasted for about 2 weeks when it was visible, because the light goes down and down until eventually you can't see it anymore. So for about 2 or 3 weeks, they could see it in light, and they could see it in X-rays, and they could see it in, they even saw radio waves coming out of the object. And the observatories all over the planet saw it. It's amazing, because the paper that came out from that observation has 4,500 authors. And 4,500 people are authors of that paper, which is amazing. I think it's the largest amount of people in any paper in astronomy in the history of science. Just to put it into perspective, 4,500 people represents about 15% of every living astronomer in the planet. So if you take 100 astronomers in the planet, 15 of them were authors of this paper all over the planet, which is amazing. It involved over 70 observatories, because it's one of the most spectacular events we have actually seen, and we could see it in many, many different waves. We could see it in light. We saw it first in gravitational waves. We saw it in gamma rays. You can study it. You can find the distance. You can find a lot of the properties of the stars that we couldn't see before. So we call this the birth of multi-messenger astronomy. The multi-messenger means precisely that. You can see it with many different types of telescopes, and everything sees something interesting. It's a very transient event. I mean, the collision lasts just a few microseconds, but then you can see this explosion that slowly dies down for about 2 or 3 weeks. And another amazing thing that happened after that is that when the light was going down, you could start to see lines of emission in the spectra of this object that indicated the presence of very heavy metals, including gold and platinum, which was amazing. I mean, this collision produced the equivalent of 10 times the mass of Earth just in gold. So maybe it's a reason to go there, but it's very far away. It's 130 million light years away. But I think everybody's excited about this, because it's only, again, a new observation of gravitational waves, a new one, because this time it was the collision of neutron stars, not black holes. And everybody else saw it with their own telescopes and observatories in many other types of light. So we've learned a lot from this collision, and we expect to see these things much more and more often. Probably in a few years we'll be seeing them once a month or something like that. But this is the first one. We haven't seen another one yet, but technology will improve. So these things happen over time on in space, and we should start to see them more and more, and that will help us learn about the nature of neutron stars, so, and about gravity and other things.
So this actually happened 100+ million years ago, if we're only seeing
exactly,
it now,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, because the light and the gravitational waves travel at the speed of light, and so if the distance is 113 million light years, it means the collision happened 113 million years ago. When these two stars collided, the Earth was roamed by dinosaurs. Yeah, and we just saw it.
So if you could fast forward, what would that region look like today?
Well, today there you probably wouldn't see much. We believe that the collision produced a black hole. So certainly today the black hole would still be there. But by now it would have swallowed every single atom of gas around it, so it would be invisible, but it would still be there. It would be just like a relic of what the explosion that happened so long ago.
I have a question taking you back to warp drive, and I have a caller on hold for you. So Bruce, yes, has this email question for you. On bubble warp drive, can you discuss relativistic speeds for observed astronomy with ionized star jets from neutron star and the relationship of observed gravity fields based on NASA spacecraft LIGO?
Oh, yeah, I found that question extremely difficult. I don't know what the warp drive has to do with the relativistic jets. So I think the question in that sense is confusing. About the relative jet LIGO, when two stars collide, we expect that all the big explosion will produce relativistic jets because there's a very large magnetic field involved. And that will produce jets in along the poles of the magnetic field. And those jets will be very fast. They'll be moving at relativistic speeds. And that means that they'll be moving at over 95% of the speed of light, the matter in those jets. When that happens, you produce gamma rays. That are very strong gamma rays, so you expect to see these gamma ray bursts, and we saw it. And so this is something we know will happen. We're not able to model it precisely today. That's one of the big unanswered questions in computational astrophysics. Nobody's able yet to computer a simulation of the formation of relativistic jets. We can put them there by hand, and then we can see how they work, but to have it actually emerge on its own is non-trivial, and nobody's been able to do it. But we do suspect that that happens, and we have confirmation from this event that it did actually happen.
He asked a quick follow-up, and then I'll go to the phone call. In the sci-fi book, The Iron Sun, it was described the measure of harnessing a primordial quarter-sized black hole. Supposedly, there are remnants of Big Bang explosions. Do you think these mini black holes phenomenon actually exist in our region of the universe?
Well, it's a good question, but we don't really know. It is possible that during the Big Bang, small black holes were produced, but we don't really know how many of them were produced, and we're not even sure they were produced. It's just a suggestion, and somebody suggested that this is possible, and we think it might be possible. We don't have enough information or data to be able to know if they were actually produced. If mini black holes were produced, then that would be very interesting because we know from Hawking's work that black holes actually radiate energy. They're not entirely black. They radiate energy because of quantum physics. But big black holes like the mass of the sun or something like that, the amount of energy they radiate is completely, it's so small that it's impossible to measure. It's completely irrelevant. And it becomes stronger when the black hole is smaller, which is interesting. So if you have very small black holes, those would radiate significant amounts of energy, and eventually they would actually explode. But they have to be very, very small. Big black holes will never do that. It will have to wait longer than the age of the universe before you would notice even any small change. So small black holes would be very interesting if they do exist.
Let's
should be able to see signatures of that, because we should be able to see these explosions every now and again from a small black hole exploding, but we haven't seen anything that looks like that yet.
Let's see who our caller is. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Okay, go.
I wanted to ask about the original detection. I saw a show about it, and they said that the size of the energy of the explosion meant that it outshone everything else in the observable universe for about 10 seconds. It was brighter than everything else put together. Is that true, the kind of energy that's been involved in?
Yeah, well, that is true. For the explosion, the original observation was the collision of two black holes, each of them about 30 times the mass of the sun. That produced the final black hole of about 60 times the mass of the sun. But actually, there was mass missing because there were three solar masses missing. The final black hole is not actually the sum of the two masses of the initial black hole. There were three solar masses missing. And that mass is missing because it turned into energy. We know, again, E equals mc squared. So that mass turned into energy. And this happened not in 10 seconds. Actually, it happened in one-tenth of a second, far less than 1 second. Mm. And if you compute the amount of energy, three times the mass of the sun converted into energy in one-tenth of a second, that is brighter than the rest of the universe combined. Of course, it's not light. If it had been light, it would have shone in the sky like crazy. But it wasn't light. It was gravitational waves. And gravitational waves first are invisible. You can't see them with your eyes. And they're also extremely weak. They're very, very hard to detect. We actually did detect them because it was so strong, but it's very difficult to detect. But yeah, the amount of energy was huge. Now, what happened to that energy? Well, that energy is flying through space, and by now it's expanded in a sphere of 1,300 light years across, which means that in any part of that sphere, the amount of energy is tiny. But if you integrate the whole sphere, then the amount of energy is still three solar masses. But it just attenuates as it goes away. It's like a wave in the sea. If you drop a stone in the sea, or in a pool, then you see a wave. That has energy, but that energy dissipates as it goes along, and the waves become smaller and smaller. The same thing happens here. So energy is conserved, but by now the energy in any given region of that explosion is so small that you can very difficult to detect.
So, and there's been several other explosions of that kind detected since. So that amount of energy being converted is a fairly common event.
It seems to be fairly common. We've seen five events so far, and we expect we'll see more. At the moment, the observatories are turned off because they're in maintenance, but when they turn them back on, we'll expect to be seeing one of these things maybe once a month. So, yeah, we expect that throughout the observable universe, these things are happening at the rate of maybe several times a week. But the observable universe is huge. I mean, there's billions of galaxies there. So, yeah, in any given galaxy, like our own galaxy, we probably would have to wait many millions of years to see just one of those. It probably happened once every million years in a given galaxy. But with billions of galaxies in the universe, you expect that to happen fairly often. So, yeah, it's happening all the time. It's amazing. But that's the reason why they're so far away, because in our own galaxy, we don't expect to see one for millions of years. So you need to look very, very far away so you can actually see billions and billions of galaxies, and then you expect to see one event in a given galaxy every now and again.
Wow. Well, I'll ask one more thing, and then I'll clear the line in case somebody else wants to call. So does this mean that is there new, with this new information about black holes, can we expect to see more new papers on black holes coming up?
I'm fairly sure, yes. Yeah, you're going to be learning about the black holes. One of the things... we're trying to see if Einstein's theory of relativity is actually perfect in the sense that it predicts everything correctly. And we would hope, and that's, we always hope these things, we hope that it doesn't, because we would hope to always learn something new. So people will be analyzing these observations with great detail to see if there's any small deviation from the prediction of Einstein's theory. And if there is a small deviation, we will learn there's something new in physics that we didn't know before. If there is no deviation, then again, we'll just say, well, Einstein was a genius because everything is fine. But we hope we will see some differences, even if it's tiny, and that will point us in the direction of new physics. But yeah, people will be using this to learn about the properties of black holes, and especially about the properties of stars. That is far more interesting. Black holes are relatively plain objects. I mean, they're simple. Stars are complex, and there's many things about stars we don't really yet understand. And we can use this information to learn more about them.
Hmm. Well, that's great. Thank you for your answers. I'll clear the line.
Thank you, Kim.
You're welcome.
Listeners, if you want to call, that line is available, and it's 866-687-7223. So I have a real space cadet question from you, from Carl in Nova Scotia. So you ready for this one? John, you'll love this one too. I happen to be a very well-informed, I think, space enthusiast who also believes that there are extraterrestrials flying around and possibly they might have visited Earth. Given your analysis of how challenging it might be to create warp drive or faster than light travel, if there really are ETs out there that have visited Earth or are flying around visiting other places, could they possibly have solved the three challenges that you're talking about? Or could they have stumbled upon new physics that we're not aware of that would allow them to travel faster than light in ways that we can't conceive? Do you think a line of new physics is even plausible?
Well, that's a very hypothetical question. First of all, I don't believe extraterrestrials have come to Earth or are flying around here. I don't see any evidence that's true. I believe that's not true. That doesn't mean I don't believe there's life outside. I'm pretty sure there must be life. The galaxy is a huge place. I'm pretty sure there's probably also extraterrestrial civilizations out there, again, because the galaxy is a huge place. But I don't think they're here. I don't see any evidence that they've ever been here. So I think we'll probably, at some point in the future, we'll meet them. Whether they know more physics than we do, almost certainly. If there's some more advanced civilization out there, they will certainly know a lot more physics than we do. Physics is not finished today. There's many things in physics we don't understand. We don't understand the origin of the universe. We don't understand, even in the standard model of particle physics, we don't know why the masses of the particles are what they are. We don't have a grand unified theory of physics. We don't have a theory of quantum gravity that works well enough that we can actually believe it. So there's a lot of things we still don't understand in physics. We only just discovered the Higgs particle a few years ago, and we haven't been able to study its properties. So there's many things that we don't know. And yes, it is certainly possible that some of these things we don't really know would allow you eventually to travel faster than light or to do things you can't even imagine today. It's perfectly possible. At the moment, we don't see an indication of that, but we could be wrong. And there's many, many interesting ideas out there. But yeah, I don't think extraterrestrials are coming to Earth. I don't believe that. But I'm pretty sure they exist somewhere out in space, somewhere out in the galaxy. And if they do, some of them will be far more advanced than we are, and they will know a lot more about the universe than we do. And I do hope one day we can contact them. I think we'll learn a lot.
So there is a fear about trying to contact them with what's called active SETI, and in fact, a group just sent signals out using active SETI rather than passive, and I got several emails from people really concerned about this. I even think Hawking is concerned about sending signals out, and it, you know, I got a lot more things on my plate to be concerned about than that.
Exactly.
But, yeah. Or something.
Say again, John. I'm sorry.
So what if we attract somebody like the Klingons or something, huh?
Well,
at least the Klingons of the original series.
exactly.
We seem to have Klingons here on Earth, so I'm not sure. Yeah. You know,
I'm not worried about that at all. I don't see what that's too worried. As I said, the galaxy is a huge place, and there's resources everywhere. Why would they come here to take our resources? What they want? Water? There's more water in the asteroids than here on Earth, and there's no one there to bother. So resources, I'm pretty sure there's resources where they live, and there's resources all over the place. I'm pretty sure also that the number of stars with no life around them is probably much higher than the number of stars with life around them. So the intelligent thing would be to go to a place that is not inhabited and take all you want. Why bother to go and bait someone else when there's so many things out there not taken by anyone? So I think that makes no sense. I think what makes sense is just the opposite. I think that life is probably... There's probably life out in their galaxy in many places, but I think it's still probably rare, relatively rare. So if you find life out there, I think it would be precious. So I don't think I don't see any advanced extraterrestrial coming here to make war and to conquer us. It makes no sense at all. It would be so advanced that for them, it would be completely uninteresting to come here. They would probably study us, but that's it. So I'm not worried at all. And even then, if you send a message with this active SETI, nobody will ever see it. I mean, we don't have the power to send a message anywhere that will have any power over there that somebody will be able to detect it. So nobody will see it. So I'm not worried at all. I do think it makes far more sense to listen because, again, we don't really have the technology to send a message powerful enough for anybody to see. But maybe they can do it, so we should listen.
John, any comments or questions from you?
Well, if we're going back to black holes, what about the role of that black holes might play in the galaxy formation? Because I know that we believe that like there's a giant black hole at the center of the Milky Way. Is this a common thing with galaxies, and could this be due to how galaxies form?
It's a good question. We don't really know for sure. There is apparently huge black holes. I mean, millions of times the mass of the sun, and sometimes billions of times the mass of the sun, in the center of essentially every large galaxy, and maybe even small galaxy. But this is a chicken and egg question. We don't know if the galaxy formed first, and then because of the high concentration of mass in the center of a newly formed galaxy, there was a lot of mass there, and then the big black hole formed. Or maybe first the black hole formed, and around the black hole things started to coalesce. We don't know. We haven't been able to answer that question. We have to model it numerically. We have to do the simulations in computers to see what happened. We don't have the computer power to do that just yet. But I think it's unlikely that the black holes formed first. And even if they did, the black holes, even though they're huge, even a 1 billion solar mass black hole, it's huge. It's 1 billion times the size of the sun. But a typical galaxy has 300 or 400 billion times the mass of the sun, or even bigger than that. So from the point of view of a galaxy, the black hole at its center is in the biggest case about 1% of the mass of the galaxy, and usually far less than that, 0.1% or 0.001%. So the black hole at the center of the galaxy is very small compared to the galaxy, so it doesn't really dominate the dynamics of the galaxy. The effect on the galaxy is very small. So I don't think that the black holes actually produce the galaxies, but it's still interesting to find out what happened first. Did you have first black holes and then the galaxies, or the other way around, and we don't know.
Yeah, because I was thinking that they might form, it kind of be like a seed, because you have a dense early universe clouds, and black holes might form, and then they would create accretion disks that would then pull the matter in, which would then become a self-perpetuating reality or something.
Yeah, it has been suggested, and people are looking into the possibility, but as I said, we don't really have the answer. It's the problem we call the problem of hierarchy. It's small things form first and then big ones, or it's the other way around. Big ones form first and then small ones. And we don't really know. In the case of big clusters of galaxy, we think it went from big to small. But in the case of one individual galaxy, we don't know.
I have another email for you. So Carolyn is in Seattle. And she says, Doctor, since you are a theoretical physicist, how theoretical is it that one day, I'm 28 years old, maybe in my lifetime, we can travel in time either forwards or backwards? Assuming I live into my late 80s or 90s, will I see that become a reality?
That's a nice question, but traveling in time is a hard problem. We believe traveling to the past is impossible. As far as we understand the laws of physics today, traveling in time to the past seems impossible, and I don't see that changing anytime soon because it would have to change all the foundations of physics. I don't see how that's going to happen. Traveling to the future is possible, but it's extremely difficult. That doesn't violate anything. Actually, we travel to the future all the time at a very slow pace, 1 second per second, but we do go to the future all the time. So the interesting thing would be to go faster to the future. That can be done. We know how to do it. There's two ways to do it. You can either build a very fast spaceship that goes at 99% of the speed of light or something like that, go to a very distant star and come back. And when you do that, you'll find out that maybe for you the trip lasted a few years. I don't know, maybe hundreds of years went by. And the other way to do it is to go very close to a black hole, find a black hole out there in space, fly to it, stay very, very close to it for some time, then come out, and you'll discover again the same thing, that for you a few years passed, and outside maybe hundreds of years, maybe even thousands of years. So that's possible. But again, in practice, it's extremely difficult. You would need to first find a black hole and go there, so which is difficult, or you would need to build a spaceship that can go at 99% the speed of light or something like that, which again, you can't do. and use it to go do a round trip to a very distant star. So I think that within our lifetimes, within the next few hundred years, it's going to be extremely unlikely. Eventually, we'll have to deal with things like that, because I do see humanity going into the stars at some point, even if we can never travel faster than light, even if we can just travel at maybe 60, 80% of the speed of light in a few hundred years. What we will see is this effect. So people that go to distant stars will age slower than people that stay on Earth. For them, there will be just be a few years. And then when they communicate back with Earth, they'll discover that Earth has aged hundreds of years. But that's a problem we'll have to deal with in the future, but I think not for hundreds of years.
But the popular idea, the TV show idea, where we can go 10 years in the future and find out the value of this or the cure to this kind of cancer or whatever, and then come back and implement that stock purchase or that cure or that right now today,
that's not what you're talking about. No, as far as we know, that's impossible. As far as we understand physics today, if you travel to the future by whatever means, you can't come back. Traveling to the past is impossible as far as physics is concerned today, and I think for the foreseeable future. I don't see how that could change. Traveling to the future is possible, but it's not a matter of getting into a machine and doing it. You need to either go to a black hole, close to a black hole, or you need to travel very close to the speed of light, very far away, and come back. Those are the only two ways we know to do it. So building a machine that can do it here, like in Doctor Who or in Back to the Future, there's simply nothing in physics that tells us that that's ever going to be possible, not at this time.
Are these ideas so complicated and challenging and difficult for a reason that maybe we don't understand, that maybe we're not supposed to be doing this stuff? Have you ever thought about that?
I don't know. I mean, we've actually learned a lot about the universe. It's not so much that we don't understand. We do understand a lot. And from what we see, many of these things don't seem to be likely. So that's one of the amazing things. I mean, we really have learned a lot about the universe. We know the basic structure of matter. We understand not only atoms, but the structure of elementary particles. We understand the structure of space-time. We know how it bends and how it curves. And so there's a lot we know. And with what we know, we can understand essentially, well, most of the phenomena we have seen in the universe. We haven't been able to see at the moment anything out there in space that we can't sort of understand in a very good sense. So I think that the amazing thing is just the opposite. We understand already a lot of the universe. So it seems difficult to imagine that there's things so different from what you understand that they're going to change everything. That's difficult to imagine at this point. It would happen, of course. It could happen that we'll discover something fundamentally different tomorrow. But at this point, one of the problems is precisely that there's nothing new. We haven't been able to see in our particle accelerators for the last 30 years or even more. Nothing that we didn't predict before. Nothing that we didn't expect. Nothing at all, which is one of the things that's disappointing, because we want to see things, new things, and we haven't seen anything in over 30 years that we didn't know before would be there, because even the Higgs particle, we knew it was going to be there. We predicted it 40 years ago. So that's amazing. We understand so much about the universe today that it seems unlikely that there's something completely different out there. I think certainly things will change. We'll understand a few other things. But something fundamental like traveling back in time, I think it's extremely unlikely.
John, we're coming close to the end. Do you have any comments toward the end of the program today?
Well, I guess I was one other thing we hadn't really addressed there was if there are these so-called M drive and things that wouldn't be faster than light, but would be kind of a reactionless, well, maybe not exactly reactionless, but apparently reactionless propulsion system, which would of course only be sublight, but would sort of be like the Star Trek's impulse drive or something. What do you think about those things?
I'm extremely skeptical. I don't believe any of that. I think whatever they're measuring, either they've measured it wrong, or there's something coming out that they haven't seen. To build this M drive, as far as I've seen, it requires you to violate energy conservation. Momentum conservation. Momentum conservation and energy conservation are the two pillars of physics. Everything is based on that. So if you violate that, you essentially threw out all of physics out the window, everything we know. Momentum conservation just comes out from the properties of space-time. There's nothing else. It just you put that into the fundamental properties of space-time, and then momentum conservation pops out. So if you don't conserve momentum, then that means you don't understand anything about space-time. Everything you know physics is wrong. So because of that, I don't believe what they're doing makes any sense. I don't, they would have to really convince me. As Carl Sagan said, and I think that was beautiful, when he says that if you have some extraordinary claim like this, you need extraordinary evidence. Not just a little bit of evidence, not just some small effect. No, you need extraordinary evidence if you're going to say you're going to withdraw all of physics. And I don't see extraordinary evidence there. I see all the opposite. Very weak evidence.
Miguel, the people who support M-Drive say that it's not violating conservation of momentum and that it's pushing off or getting resistance from the entire solar system. That's hard for me to grasp, but then I'm not a physicist. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't see how that makes any sense. What I've read is they start talking about the zero-point field and things like that we don't really even understand. So just when you start talking about those things, it's just like waving your hands because you're saying we don't understand this and we don't understand that, so maybe the two are related, and that doesn't make any sense to me.
Nothing on the horizon to propel us real fast, real soon?
Not like that. I think other things will propel us fast and relatively soon. I'm hoping on ion drives. I think ion drives are the wave of the future, and we need to push that technology. That's extremely feasible. We understand it. It works. The impulse is weak, but we can improve on that. And I see ion drives taking us, maybe not to the stars, but certainly to the whole solar system in the next few decades. So I think that's a technology we should really push.
You're talking about the mass of people and spaceships, not just little wafers, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think if you improve on ion drive technology, eventually we should be able to propel a spaceship with people with that thing. Well, it's plasma drives and things like that. I think that would be completely plausible in the next few decades, maybe in the next 100 years, to push us all the way through the solar system. And that's known physics, and it works. There's no doubt about that. It won't be enough to push us to the stars, but I think to push us to the solar system is certainly enough. To push us to the stars, I think speculative ideas, not so speculative, but something like an antimatter drive. An antimatter drive, again, is perfectly feasible and possible. Again, the technology is extremely difficult. You will need to be able to hold antimatter safely and in sufficient quantities for very long times, and that's extremely hard to do. We don't know how to do it. But there's nothing about that that seems impossible. So I think maybe that's the way to go to the stars.
John, any concluding comments from you?
Well, the other possibility on that would be, of course, a fusion-powered spaceship using helium-3 and deuterium if you could find enough helium-3 somewhere.
Exactly. I agree completely. A fusion drive would be fantastic as well. Again, we need to control fusion, and we still can't do that, but I think we'll solve that problem.
Yeah.
Any concluding comments that you want to leave us with today, Miguel?
Well, yeah, just to say that all these things are interesting. There's a lot of things happening in physics. The universe is not necessarily what we want it to be. It is what it is, but there's still a lot of things to learn about the universe. I think these things we've discovered over black holes and neutron stars are gravitational waves are absolutely fantastic. And they show us that we're still learning things about the universe. The universe still has things to teach us. And we can learn about them, and spectacular things are happening out there, and slowly we're learning about them, and we'll learn to see them. So it's exciting times of physics still ahead of us.
I want to thank you very much for being with us on the Space Show program and talking to us about these issues, and it's really been interesting, and I hope we get a chance to connect with you again down the road on some other big physics news that may come up. So you probably will hear from me again. But this has been great, and thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for the invitation as well.
And John, you too. And as soon as I get it archived, I'll send you the information, and all the best to you, and thank you again. Oh, one more quick question, okay? Real quick.
Yeah.
The gravitational wave tie you wore at Starship, where did you get that?
I bought it online. I don't remember the exact site, but I'm pretty sure you look for it in Google, it'll pop up, because that's how I got it. I bought it online.
Gravitational wave tie.
For, a gravitational wave tie, and for females, it's actually a gravitational wave dress, a full dress.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, I've seen it as well, but for males, it's only the tie.
It'd be cool if they had it as a hat, too, but maybe down the road.
That's true.
Thank you again, and all the best for a great holiday season coming up for you and your family, too.
Same to you. Thanks.
Okay. Listeners, that's it. We thank Miguel and John for being with us, and open lines on Sunday. Everybody, make sure to listen then, too. Goodbye from John, Miguel, David, and the Space Show.